Consensus standards for light sport aircraft. What are they? How does it work? And who is ASTM? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for the download today. We're back today with Ed Downs, who is a veteran of aviation in pretty much every facet, but these days works to help companies through the ASTM compliance process, and in particular is working with at least one manufacturer of gyroplanes on the issue of getting it through the ASTM process to become an experimental or a special light sport aircraft. We talked yesterday on the special feature about the gyroplane story specifically. I wanted to get Ed back today to talk specifically about the ASTM process because in preparing to have this conversation, Ed told me some things and offered some things in depth that I have never heard explained as well before. Ed, welcome back.
Well, I'm glad to be back, and let's see if we can avoid becoming a legal geek on this and try to take some of the mystification out of the ASTM process.
All right. Well, let's talk about, first of all, what ASTM is, because I think there are some misconceptions there. We see the ASTM label on everything from, as you mentioned, garbage bags. I've seen it on the Dyson commercials on TV as a disclaimer about how they measured the suction. But when we get around to aircraft in particular, let's talk about how this process differs. Let's start by, what is ASTM? Who are these people?
Well, you know, it's funny when you say, what does the acronym stand for? Interestingly enough, ASTM no longer defines what the acronym means. They refer to themselves as ASTM International. Now, I'm probably going to mess this up, but I seem to recall it originally stood for something like American Standards and Technical Measures or something very close to that. But they recognized fairly early in the formation of the company, which is probably 120 years old, by the way, that they were going to be an international organization. When we think of something called an ASTM standard, technically, there is no such thing. What we're really referring to is an industry consensus standard that has been derived under a process governed by this private organization called ASTM International. Mm-hmm. In other words, ASTM International has a structure into which many companies can move into, and they can argue with each other about what their products should look like, how they should measure standards. And ASTM is the referee in this system. They have committees established. They have procedures for committees and comments and technical resources. The ASTM itself does not set the standards. Sometimes folks think, gee, ASTM is a standard-setting company. No, it's not. ASTM is an organization under which standards are established by the industries themselves. Therefore, when we're referring to the light sport aircraft, a light sport aircraft, or an SLSA, a special light sport aircraft, is certified to an industry consensus standards as derived from the ASTM process. That's the technical way of looking at it.
Okay, now let's talk about this whole debate about ASTM, the ASTM process versus, for example, Part 23. And I'm going to lean back briefly on our discussion yesterday of gyroplanes. Here is a niche interest where only a tiny fraction of the pilot population will ever fly one of these things. The Part 23 process to get a standard category airworthiness certificate is, you know, pretty much a $100 million deal going in. It's cost prohibitive for someone who's trying to cater to that smaller market. On the other hand, some people have said that the ASTM process, where industry gets together and says these are the standards, self-certifies, backed up by an audit process, could wind up one day replacing the standard airworthiness process as we've known it since the 1930s. Give us a little background on the difference between the two systems and what you maybe see going forward.
Right. The FAR 23 and prior to that, the CAR 3 and prior to that, the CAR 4B and all the other certification processes that have been done by the government in the past have been, as I think most of us imagine them, these are bureaucrats and technical bureaucrats. to get together and make decisions on the goodness or badness of a particular design or system in aviation. It could be an aircraft design. It could be an air traffic control system, for that matter. And these people have in the past simply cast down from a high rules and regulations to govern us, the users of the system. Now, in all fairness, these are talented people. And indeed, most of the rules and regulations we see in aviation today are regrettably written in blood. There's some experience behind this. However, in 1996, there was a federal act passed. It was called the National Technology Transfer and Advancement Act. I'm sure that rolls off the tongue of all the listeners. But this act was interesting because it said, hey, Mr. Regulator, Mr. Government, if you are a regulator that answers to the executive branch of government, in other words, cabinet position, clearly the FAA does, we don't want you to simply cast down rules from a high anymore, because that's hurting industry. It's shutting down technology. It's doing a lot of things, because you know what? Industry really knows more about their business than you do. And they're right. Industry does.
Mm-hmm.
So this act said, okay, Mr. Regulator, you need to consult with the stakeholder and develop some kind of consensus standard before you make regulations. That is where the ASTM aircraft certification process came from. This was passed in 1996. Sport pilot began to really kind of cook in 1998 and 1999. And it was it has been held up as a prime example of using consensus standards for a very, very complicated issue. And you are correct, Paul. I've seen several reports recently where the FAA is now openly considering using the ASTM process for a number of certification issues that used to be handled strictly in-house, kind of in the FAA ivory tower kind of capacity. And they're saying, you know what? This ASTM thing works. The consensus standard is working. So it's going to expand.
I see a couple of potential problems with this shift in philosophy, and I want to talk to you about them after the break. My guest is Ed Downs. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from AeroNews.
You hear that sound? It's one of the all-time great inventions. Takes lids off cans just like that. But now, let's picture something even bigger. A tool that can take the lid off a whole airport. Actually, thousands of airports. It's a Garmin WAAS GPS. Lets you make glide path approaches using runways that were once closed tight during IFR conditions. Hey, if you're going to fly in the soup, you got to have an opener. Garmin WAAS GPS. Follow the leader.
Diamond Aircraft's D-Jet is the ultimate private aircraft for the owner-flown market, offering simplicity of operation, safety, and affordability. Imagine starting the turbine with a simple push of a button. Push the single-lever throttle forward. Monitor your flight on the cutting-edge G1000 with integrated autopilot and enjoy the reliability, performance, smoothness, and quiet of turbine power. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3222.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Ed Downs talking about the ASTM process, industry consensus standards, and how it impacts light sport aircraft. Ed, we talked before the break about the shift in philosophy that seems to be underway at the FAA, away from mandates coming down on scrolls and toward a process where industry determines what the standards for its product category will be and then self-certifies and, in some cases, self-audits performance to them. I see two big shifts that this brings on. One of them is government regulation is often sought by large competitors in an industry as a means to make entry into their product category cost prohibitive for new competition. A barber or a beautician working in your local town has to have a permit or license in order to cut hair for money. That keeps out the person who would do it part-time informally. How is industry in general going to react to what appears to be a lowering of the barrier for new competitors?
Actually, I think it's reacting very well to it. This can be seen by the fact that in the last, well, since 2004, when the sport pilot rule and therefore SLSA certification came into effect, there have been in the neighborhood of 100 new aircraft certified. clearly, when the standard was prepared by the people who were on committee and writing it at that time, we all knew that it was going to open up the market. At least we hoped it would. We recognized, especially in aviation, that recreational aviation had become very expensive, very stagnant, very non-creative. It was our hope that the ASTM process and the industry standard, consensus standard process, would revitalize this. Now, it has. The amount of activity has been absolutely phenomenal. Beyond that, we also know that some companies are better than others, some are smarter than others, some are better funded than others, and that there will be a culling out. Those of us in the industry who have confidence in our products and confidence in our manufacturing capabilities don't really fear the competition. In fact, compared to where many of us came from, which was either the ultralight industry or the experimental kit manufacturer, we enjoy the fact that there is actually a standard established that people have to certify that they meet. Because in the experimental world, your competition is not perhaps another airplane or another gyroplane competitor. It's a website that claims to have something that's better than what you sell, mm-hmm. with absolutely no requirement to verify those claims. In the world of ASTM, that has come to an end.
It'll become somewhat of a brand to have the LSA stamp on your aircraft in that regard, which I agree is good. The other big shift I think we're going to have to get used to, moving out of Part 23 type certification requirements into industry consensus standards, is, as you mentioned yesterday, a somewhat of a buyer beware world. To what extent can people have confidence in light sport aircraft and maybe looking ahead into the future, even larger aircraft, more complex aircraft that have been through an industry consensus process rather than a government bureaucracy?
Well, it is a buyer beware situation. The company that puts out a SLSA consensus standard flying machine basically signs a statement of compliance that says, I complied with everything. The question is, what is everything? And a buyer needs to understand that that aircraft must have met actually five different standards. My recommendation is that the individuals involved in purchasing an SLSA-type aircraft perhaps spend some time on the web. First of all, our good friends with the FAA on the FAA.gov website, they have very good definitions and descriptions of what you should expect to see in terms of documentation. The Experimental Aircraft Association on their website, EAA.org, also has excellent information. There are such things as pilot operating handbooks that have to meet a particular standard. The buyers need to understand that indeed that standard has to include a training manual. It has to include some way that the buyer interfaces with continuing airworthiness. I counsel individuals that I work with to basically look at documentation. They need to be informed as to what documentation should be with the airplane. The seller should very cordially and happily display that documentation. I'm not sure if the mention of brands is appropriate, but a company managed by a personal friend of mine, Tom Pegany, the CT aircraft, if a person were to look at the kind of documentation CT offers, they would see what is a good example of what the industry has to show for itself.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you mentioned Tom in particular, because Flight Design USA has recently been through the LAMA audit process. Tom told me that even they, who are kind of on the leading edge of this, and Tom, who's been involved heavily with LAMA, said that even they learned a couple of things about their own documentation and processes through this audit situation. How effective are the audits, and is LAMA doing a good job?
Yeah, I think they are. And, of course, LAMA is a Light Aircraft Manufacturers Association, one of the many alphabet groups that manufacturers could join. LAMA does an audit of all this documentation, and it's the kind of thing consultants like me do also, where we take a look at it. I think they're doing an excellent job. And, of course, I reference Tom because he is a personal friend of mine. He was also the chairman of the ASTM Fixed Wing Committee for a long period of time. So, Tom kind of knows how things are supposed to work. But the audits are going very well. I think certainly a consumer would kind of look for the Llama sticker and say, hey, have you guys been through a Llama audit? Have you been through any form of audit as far as your certification process is concerned? This is the side of consensus standard that one does need to be cautious about. And regrettably, many purchasers don't understand some of the fine points. You know, one of the main issues with an SLSA is continued airworthiness. We all know that with a FAR 23 certified type airplane, the FAA is responsible for that. A&P mechanics make reports through a well-known process to the FAA. Maintenance documents or maintenance bulletins can be issued for standard certified type aircraft. Airworthiness directives can be issued. That structure is a factory structure in the case of an LSA, and it requires that the owner of the aircraft participate in it. Do owners really understand that kind of thing? These are issues of an educational standpoint that perhaps the buyer, if nothing else, would talk to the seller of an SLSA and say, hey, seller, tell me about your documentation. How do I participate in continued airworthiness? Does your POH have a training manual in it? Simple questions along that line will either get you an answer that is filled with confidence and a good, quick, concise response. And yeah, I think that'll give you a good feeling of comfort. Always ask to see those particular documents. Or you may find that the individual involved fumbles and doesn't have a clue what the buyer's talking about. Well, that certainly puts up warning flags.
Well, one final question about the process, and I think if we haven't already done so, this will be the summer we pass 100 light sport aircraft in the marketplace.
That's my understanding, yes.
In terms of continued airworthiness and the administrative process for that, we know that not all these 100 companies will be around in 5 years. What will happen to the people who own those aircraft? I know, there are certain implications of an orphaned type certificate in Part 23. What's the equivalent in the consensus standards?
That's handled really in two ways. One, in the ASTM standard for the continuing airworthiness, there is a specific provision that allows another company to purchase, or that is to acquire, the continued airworthiness end of a design, meaning that there's really an advantage for individuals who might be familiar with a particular design of going into business supporting them. Secondly, the maintenance manual has a lot to do with who can do maintenance and how the maintenance is done on the aircraft. That's one thing that is very different in the SLSA world. Not only does the manual say this is how you tighten a bolt, it says, and furthermore, this is the guy who can do it. So this was considered in the writing of the standards itself, and there is a pathway which is perhaps actually superior to what we have in FAR 23.
Well, Ed, this is a fascinating new world. We may wind up seeing it affect much larger aircraft than LSAs in the future if it works out. It has to be a breath of fresh air administrative workload-wise for the FAA, and I want to be able to check back with you from time to time and kind of keep on top of it.
Well, Paul, I'd be delighted to talk with you. While I am semi-retired at this particular point and working principally as a consultant, I really enjoy watching the fruits of the labor of a lot of people who were involved in this, including myself. And it is very exciting to see where this is leading and the fact that the entire process is going to be expanded into other aspects of aviation. I think it's quite a success story, and I think all the folks that participated in the original sport pilot regulation and those who continue to participate are to be congratulated. They've done a fine job.
Well, Ed, if anyone who's listening or anyone in a company would want more information about your services as a consultant, where do they find that?
They can always contact me at my email address, and the email is simply ed@kindredspiritsranch.com. And that's the name of my ranch.
Well, I know you have a mama alpaca who's about to give birth.
I sure do.
We won't hold you any longer, but we really appreciate your input today.
Right. Well, it's going to be an on-time arrival, so I'm kind of looking forward to the event. Paul, I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
My guest has been Ed Downs. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.